This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Later, we'll run through the day's top local stories, from a new WBEZ data analysis about detainees at the West Suburban ICE detention facility, to whether or not Mayor Johnson will veto the budget, to some changes on the White Sox roster. We'll break down those stories in just a bit. But first, for a lot of people right now, just covering the basics feels harder than it should. I'm talking about keeping a roof over your head, putting food on the table, and staying afloat month to month. Rent keeps climbing, paychecks aren't keeping up, and the math just isn't mathing for many households.
People who are currently experiencing homelessness, those who are currently in shelter or currently outside, no longer have an option for housing because there are no longer referrals being made for housing placements.
At the Food Depository, we say that hunger is a policy choice, and there is nothing more illustrative of that than this moment. We have had previous government shutdowns before, but we have never missed a month of SNAP.
One of the special things about Pilsen is, you know, our street vendors, people playing instruments, and just seeing the same people every day in our grocery stores. But when we first heard about ICE coming to our neighborhoods, the first thing I noticed is our streets were like dead. Mm-hmm. We didn't really see people out.
We are providing free grocery runs that includes pickup and drop off to their home, and in addition, free Lyft gift cards. So then if they do have to leave their home, they at least have a sense of minimizing the risk.
That strain is showing up in a very public way. According to the latest end of year report from GoFundMe, we are seeing more people launching campaigns that are looking for help to pay for housing, utilities, and food. In this next conversation, we'll dig into why affordability is slipping in the Chicago area and what mutual aid efforts and policy shifts could help ease the gap. At the table was Dion Dawson, founder and executive director of Dion's Chicago Dream, and Bob Palmer, who's policy director of Housing Action Illinois. And later, we'll hear from Congressman Brad Schneider, who represents Illinois' 10th district that includes some of Chicago's northern suburbs. Here's the conversation. So I want to hear from you both on this first one. Just give me your reaction to what I just said, right? We've got an increase in crowdfunding on GoFundMe for something I personally thought I wouldn't see, right? People asking to help them cover basic necessities. You first, Dion.
Well, I mean, when you look at it, crowdfunding should never be the crutch that becomes the norm. And so, you know, just my initial response to that is extremely unfortunate. You know what I mean? It was never meant to be the plan. You know what I mean? This is a red flag. It's something that we really need to address, and we really need to not only acknowledge, like you said, in policy, mm-hmm. but also just really come to terms with, you know, how much GoFundMe on one hand, the intent of GoFundMe and how amazing it is to have a platform where we can crowdsource and be there for each other. But also, this also speaks to the execution on the other side and the social safety net and what's really not there. So I'll just, you know, just yeah. by starting, I'll say it's really unfortunate that the data is showing that this is no longer something that's trending. This is something that is extremely alarming.
Yeah, and Bob, what strikes me from Dion's statement there is when he says, you know, this wasn't supposed to be the plan. What's on your mind?
Well, I think people are using the latest technology to meet their needs like they've always done. When I heard about the report, I was reminded of the rent parties that I know happened like back in the Depression that people would have to get their basic needs mm-hmm. met. And people are doing the same thing now. But I agree, it's a very poor reflection of our public policy and our public priorities in our country, because particularly on housing, that's the issue I'm focused on. You know, mm-hmm. it should be something that the public sector, the government, is providing the resources to make sure that everyone has an affordable place to live.
Yeah, absolutely. Say more on that, Bob. Tell me why this could be viewed then as a failure of the government.
Well, people are, and again, it's great that they exist, and I have donated to them myself for various needs, particularly like healthcare issues, I know are very common GoFundMes when people have these really emergencies. But when you get into relying on GoFundMe just to pay your monthly bills, it really reflects that in our society, people are having a hard time affording the rent, having a hard time, you know, paying their insurance premiums or their car insurance, anything that's a daily or regular cost of living. And we need to be working, you know, as a society to increase people's incomes, but also create the public resources for whatever it is, housing, healthcare, employment, that people can pay their bills without having to rely on essentially a charity to get by.
Yeah. Let's talk, Dion, about what this looks like on the ground, right? Because in 4 years, you have managed to distribute weekly produce boxes to over 2,000 residents. And, I mean, you're doing great work. I see your van. I actually see your van all the time in, you know, the South Shore area, for instance, right?
Absolutely.
I know you're out there doing the thing, but what does it feel like on your end actually trying to bridge the gap? Because there's no way you can reach everyone.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, let's talk about, you know, the hard numbers right now. So, you know, right now, those numbers have increased. So right now, Dion Chicago Dream is not only delivering in all 77 Chicagoland neighborhoods, because food insecurity, it's not about where you live. It's about the circumstances and whether or not you have access and quality. We're providing about 250,000 pounds of fresh produce per month to 5,300 households all throughout the county. And so when we think about this, you know, let's just look at it. You know, Chicago is a city where food costs are up, rent is up, utilities are up, wages have not kept pace. And so you have families, you know, families aren't bad at budgeting. They're navigating structural pressures from every direction. And when we look at our data, ever since we've had, you know, the SNAP Armageddon and the ICE raids and all of these things that are continuously shocking a system that has already been outshocked, then what we're seeing is, you know, all of our households, we're seeing a 72% slower roll-off rate for our households who feel they're in a better position. Mm-hmm. What we've seen is our wait list explode beyond 4,000 households. What we've seen is, you know, we even underwrote increasing our delivery list by more than 300 households, you know, because of all of these things that are going on. And so, you know, even our weekly signups have tripled, you know, to the wait list. And so on the ground, you know, we see that when neighbors turn to GoFundMe, it's not because they want to, it's because policy and resources have not caught up to reality.
Yeah. So you're feeling the financial pinch at your organization level too?
Absolutely. Yeah? Absolutely. And you know, this is something that, you know, goes beyond just food. And, you know, even I'm sure Bob, you know, can speak to it when it comes to housing, because even when you think about it, you know, housing and food are inseparable. You know, when rent rises, food budgets shrink. When utilities right. spike, groceries become optional. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Bob, your organization, I hear, is getting daily calls for rental assistance. Do you sometimes have to maybe turn folks away?
Well, we're not a direct service provider, so we always refer people elsewhere. And often in the city of Chicago, we ask people to call 311 for their, especially if they're homeless and they're looking for shelter. But we have always received many calls from people who are facing eviction, people who are homeless, mm-hmm. people who are maybe living in a double duff situation that's temporary. They have to move, all sorts of different scenarios. And that's really been constant. Nothing specifically has changed like in the last couple months, but the calls just keep coming. And unfortunately, yeah. we're referring people to programs that have waiting lists that are oftentimes are closed and are not that easy to access, particularly with housing. It's, you know, very expensive to provide, and it's difficult to address that problem in our society unless the government is really committed and we're doing all sorts of different public policies to build more housing, because we're not going to solve the affordability crisis until we build more housing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, talking more about some of the reasons why housing is out of reach for a lot of folks right now, we know Illinois' minimum wage is $15 an hour. Your yearly out of reach report, Bob, it shows people need to make nearly double that, actually, if they want to afford a 2-bedroom apartment. Isn't that right?
Yes, actually more than that. In the Chicago area, the housing wage for a fair average 2-bedroom apartment is about $34 an hour. That's if you're not paying more than 30% of your income in housing. But we know a lot of people who are earning less than that, earning minimum wage or even earning like $20 an hour, often paying like 50 or 60% or more of their income just for housing, and that puts them at risk of eviction, and it means they don't have much left over at the end of the month to buy food, you know, to make sure they have health insurance, to pay for the gas in their car, pay for their CTA pass.
Yeah, and we should note a WBEZ analysis earlier this year, after adjusting for inflation, showed that Chicago's median household income grew by just 9% from 2000 to 2023. So over 23 years, just 9%. The income grew, but the median cost for rent and utilities, that grew by 28%. Now, on the heels of SNAP payments being paused last month, Dion, and all the fears of ICE keeping many Chicagoans inside their homes, they were fearful to leave for groceries. You know, we also just recently saw a group of alders include a grocery tax as part of the alternative budget proposal in Chicago. Just give me your thoughts on all of that movement there.
I mean, listen, you know, right now Chicago is in a budget moment where everyone says they want affordability. We talk about this affordability crisis. But there's a tension about who pays for it. You know, too often the burden falls on working families, small businesses, and communities already stretched thin. And so affordability must be structural, not symbolic. I mean, look at, you know, the moment we're in where we have a city council who, you know, passes a budget, you know, a mayor who wants to add a head tax. Everybody's, you know, agreeing that affordability is an issue, and we're disagreeing on who should foot the bill. And so when you think about that, it is extremely costly to live right now. And, you know, what I, even in this morning when I just wrote penned an op-ed that was released this morning speaking about this. But in 2026, Chicago will have the year we deserve. And we have to really wrestle with it, with understanding that Chicago is at its best when Chicagoans are empowered, accountable, and dialed in. And I just don't think that when you talk about this affordability crisis, that we all are on the same page in terms of who will have to foot the bill for how expensive it is to live right now.
Joining us now on the line is Congressman Brad Schneider. He represents Illinois' 10th district that includes some of the Chicago northern suburbs. He also chairs the New Democrat Coalition, which is a group of moderate Democrats. Welcome to the program, Representative.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you've been listening along to the conversation, so I think you get the gist here. This is urgent, but do you feel that urgency?
Oh, absolutely. Everywhere I go through my district, I'm in the northern suburbs of Chicago, from Wilmette up to the Wisconsin border, from Waukegan all the way out west to Hebron in McHenry County. Everywhere I go, people are feeling the pinch of rising cost of living. The president talks about affordability being a hoax. Talk to anyone who's looking at their bank account where there's zero money left a week, 2 weeks before the end of the month, and they've got bills to pay. Life is increasingly difficult for too many families.
So how do you think we got here, and where do you think we go from here to change that narrative for folks?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned in the earlier segment, it's not happened overnight. It's been exacerbated over the last year. Prices, and President Trump talked about lowering prices. Many of the things he's done has increased prices, from tariffs. You can go down the long list. But this has been a long developing issue where, you know, the productivity gains in the economy haven't been spread evenly or fairly throughout the economy. Too many people are forced to work in lower wage jobs, oftentimes working two or even three jobs just to put a roof over their head, to provide mm-hmm. their kids with education and healthcare and groceries. So we need to work at trying to create more high quality jobs. This is what the new Dems are talking about. Our platform is built on three pillars: a growing economy, creating quality jobs and lowering the cost of living, people living in healthy and safe communities everywhere in this country, and a strong national security, national defense that advances American interests and makes sure America continues to lead in the world.
I'm glad you mentioned the three pillars there, but I want you to give us some tangible steps, Representative, that you're taking to introduce bills that'll make life more affordable for Illinoisans.
Sure, and I'll point to what we're doing in the New Democratic Coalition. Building on those three pillars, we have been rolling out various action plans and agendas, frameworks for legislation, healthcare, on trying to reduce the cost of energy in a smart, safe way to increase the utility distribution grid, to lower the cost of energy for American families. It's working to support our rural communities, rural revitalization, to help bring down the cost of groceries in the stores. But at the same time, creating the jobs in the knowledge economy, where AI doesn't necessarily eliminate jobs, but we are educating our people to use artificial intelligence to lead the world and create the jobs of the future. So across the board, everything we're doing is focused on those three pillars of economic growth and opportunity, strong, safe, and healthy communities, and strong national security.
Yeah, to that end, I mean, we are certainly hearing politicians overall talk more these days about the issue.
There's this fake narrative that the Democrats talk about, affordability. They just say the word. It doesn't mean anything to anybody.
An issue top of mind for voters with high property taxes, housing costs, and utility bills.
My opponent has voted against over $1 billion in property tax relief for people.
I know that for tens of thousands of New Yorkers, this meeting is between two very different candidates who they voted for the same reason. They wanted a leader who would take on the cost of living crisis that makes it impossible for working people to afford living in this city.
A poster child of our failure as a state is the issue of poverty that's out on the streets and sidewalks as it relates to encampments and homelessness.
So, you know, Dion and Bob, affordability is clearly the word of the moment, right? Mm-hmm. The New York Times, however, reports that in congressional emails, if you look through them, the umbrella term was only mentioned sparingly in past years, less than once a month in 2021, six times a month in 2023. But this year, in 2025, it begins to increase, and recently 70 times a month in November and December. What does it feel like for you all to hear affordability finally be on politicians' radar? You first, Bob.
Well, it feels way overdue. I think historically there's been a lot of focus on, you know, the economy and kind of what's happening in the economy. But I think affordability really focuses it on how the economy is impacting and affecting people in their everyday lives. So in that way, again, it's way overdue, again, focused on looking at the cost of housing, the cost of food, and the cost of other basic necessities. That's really determines how well people are doing or not, and how much people are struggling or not. And it's just the more effective way to look at how well our society is doing or not.
Dion?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it goes without saying that, you know, I'm appreciative of the attention on affordability. But also, you know, I'm thankful that, you know, I joke with my team, I have a PhD in struggling. So thankfully, you know, this, how I was raised and what I went through allowed me to understand the importance of the tangible value add for everyone that's going through this pinch. And so I think, you know, just like in your questioning to the representative, you spoke about, okay, well, what are the hardcore things we can do? And I love that affordability is the focus, but because we have so many people who are so disconnected to that struggle, there's not a lot of, you know, things that we can do day to day to really do that. And so that's why I think, like you spoke about and like you alluded to, having those policy focuses is extremely important, which mm-hmm. is something that we've been focused on at Dion Chicago Dream.
Well, you know, Representative, at a press conference in early September, you talked about Americans not feeling like the dream of owning a home is within reach, right? And you said as much here today. But renting an apartment, when you think about it, that's also out of reach for thousands of people. So talk to us a bit more about what you're doing to make sure rent is affordable and more rental properties are being built. And just that whole conversation about affordability, that it's not just a talking point.
Right. And you know, affordability starts with it's housing, it's groceries, it is healthcare, it is your utility bills. And it's all those are the basic needs. And specifically for housing, we need to increase the supply at all price levels, but in particularly for young people just starting out, for families who are struggling. You got families with multiple kids living in two-room apartments. We need to increase that supply. So how do we do that? We need to give incentives for more people to building homes and apartments. We need to help make those homes and apartments more affordable. One of the things that we talked about in the election last year was tax incentives to help young families, first-time home buyers, get into their home. But as you said, not everyone wants to buy or can buy a home, that we help renters get into a home that they can afford and gives them the space and the community that they and their families deserve.
Yeah.
So it is a combination of federal, state and local laws that we need to work with at the federal level. It's working to give help to folks in affording their homes.
Yeah. And if we had more time, Bob, we'd talk about more about your legislation that you're working on to get transparency in fees that are associated with moving into a new rental property. But before we wrap here, I'd love to hear from you both on just any efforts or groups or folks that you want to shout out real quick that are helping connect people to food and to housing.
Well, you go first, Bob.
Well, I think in Illinois, there's a whole network. Every county has one called the Continuum of Care that coordinates the homeless services. It's really focused on looking at the main cause of homelessness is the shortage of affordable housing. And unfortunately, many of the policies we're seeing from the Trump administration now are not focused on looking at homelessness as an affordable housing problem. They're more focused on blaming people for their own homelessness. So that's something, obviously, we find very concerning and wrongheaded.
No, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, of course, I would love to, you know, shout out Growing Home. They've been amazing there in Inglewood with, you know, Janelle's team. You have Erica Allen and the Urban Girls Collective. You even have, you know, different various mutual aid groups. You have Healthy Hood. You have, you know, Windy City Harvest. You have, even just from a health perspective, you have the Peace Runners who are doing a lot with health and wellness out of West Garfield Park. But I would just like to, you know, just round it out and just say 2026 needs to be not a year of catch-up crisis or compromise. I mean, it can be a year that Chicago meets the moment with compassion, strategy, and policy because I know we want to thrive and I know we want to contribute and our leaders have to make sure that we make that possible because Chicago has always been leaders from the front, not from the back, and I expect that we need to do that in a year moving forward.
Leaving us on a positive note, Dion Dawson's founder and executive director of Dion's Chicago Dream. Bob Palmer is policy director for Housing Action Illinois, and Congressman Brad Schneider represents Illinois' 10th district. Thank you all so much.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down was Claire Lane, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor, and Mitchell Armentrout, Chicago Sun-Times reporter. Mitch kicked us off with the latest from the Broadview ICE facility, which state lawmakers recently visited.
Right. Lawmakers have been trying to get into this Broadview facility basically since the Fed's immigration siege started back in September, and they were let in this time. I should say last month, Representative Lauren Underwood from the Western Suburbs also visited the facility. And on Friday, Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy got a look inside. But yesterday, it was Jonathan Jackson, Delia Ramirez, Chewy Garcia, and some other folks from the Democratic delegation. And, you know, they basically said some of the things that we've heard from the other representatives, which is that it's not great conditions inside this facility. It's not designed to hold a lot of people. Mm-hmm. There were only two people being held yesterday, right, which just kind of goes to show, you know, how quickly things ramp up and back down when the feds come in and out with these immigration raids across Chicago. But they basically said that, you know, these are not humane conditions to keep people in.
And relatedly, Claire, we've got new WBEZ data about detainees at Broadview. What did our colleagues find?
Right. So our WBEZ analysis shows people held at Broadview are getting transferred or have been transferred to dozens of facilities across the country. So during the first half of this Operation Midway Blitz, WBEZ found detainees were shuttled much farther distances than they were before or had been previously from this facility. They went to places, other facilities in Texas, Louisiana, even Arizona. So in 2024, under the Biden administration, the vast majority of detainees at Broadview were transferred to two primary facilities and neighboring in Wisconsin and Indiana. So advocates say that this change is because of the lack of capacity, as Mitch is mentioning, at ICE facilities to really just handle the sheer volume of people being detained.
Mm-hmm. Now, meanwhile, the U.S. Justice Department suing Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and Attorney General Kwame Raoul. This is over the state's new law aimed at limiting immigration enforcement in the courthouses. What are the details there, Claire?
So the Sun-Times is reporting that this law, which, as we remember, was just signed by Pritzker this month in response to Operation Midway Blitz, bars immigration enforcement from taking place in or around courthouses. So, you know, like in parking lots or on lawns near the front entrances or back entrances, and opens the door for easier legal action against federal agents over possible civil rights infractions. So the DOJ is claiming, you know, what this lawsuit is claiming is that Illinois law is unconstitutional and says that states have no regulatory authority to over federal actions or where they can take place, which Pritzker, as we know, has been very adamant about trying to enforce here in Illinois.
Right. What do you make of this story, Mitch?
You know, back in October when lawmakers were writing this legislation, this was a really hot topic in Springfield during the veto session. And everyone kind of acknowledged that this was a law that was going to be challenged. It wasn't a matter of if it would be challenged. It was, everyone was pretty sure that this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And because, you know, obviously the Trump administration has been quick to point out that, you know, they point to the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. They say they will apprehend criminals where they find them, regardless of if it's a courthouse, a hospital, a daycare center, a community college. Those are kind of the territories that state lawmakers, Democratic state lawmakers, were trying to sort of tamp down on deportation operations from being carried out. So I think this is like a lot of other things that we've seen this year. This is going to come down to a court fight. Hard to say exactly what kind of odds it could face in a Chicago area courtroom, but figure to see this really percolate pretty high up in the court system by early next year.
And now shifting to city council here, Mitch, we're also on veto watch, right? And since that budget passed over the weekend, Mayor Brandon Johnson has 5 days, I believe, to veto or not to veto. Has there been any action yet?
We haven't gotten any word from the mayor yet. Reporters certainly have tried to get him to say what his next move is in this budget battle. The ball is right now in his court over the weekend. We saw a slightly larger number of aldermen support this budget package. That's, you know, this is the rival package to one that he had. Obviously, the crux of that debate is the corporate head tax that he really wants to implement on large corporations doing business in Chicago. So there are 30 aldermen who supported it. That's 4 short of a veto-proof majority. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the mayor he's kind of laying the groundwork for potentially going along with this. You know, he hasn't said he's going to veto it. He says he's morally opposed to it, but he's also is quick to point out that this proposal is essentially more than 98% in line with his own.
Right.
So, you know, certainly trying to potentially lay the groundwork for saying, you know, we can take our wins here, even if, you know, maybe the one thing that he's really is pushed for the hardest this budget cycle doesn't make it to the finish line.
Right.
But again, he's still got a few more days to make a decision here.
And if things do go the other way, right, and we do end up in a government shutdown in Chicago, I mean, how do you think Chicagoans would react if that were to happen?
I think that's really something that Brandon Johnson doesn't want to deal with. You know, it's not an election year for him.
He was pretty clear. He would do whatever it takes.
Right. And it's not an election year for him, but it kind of feels like it already, the way things are going. Some other candidates sort of lining up for the 2027 election. But, you know, this is a city that Jane Byrne was famously voted out after a tough go of it with city plows not clearing the roads after a big snowstorm. So, yeah, a lack of city services, not what any Chicago mayor wants to see.
Yeah, what do you think Chicagoans would do if we got there, Claire?
Well, I think, sadly, we've gotten pretty accustomed to the government being shut down this year anyway, I think, with the exception of trash, you know, not being picked up, delays in transportation, right? Mitch is alluding to plows not plowing. Chicagoans will endure. Remember, people, you know, will be asked to work and very well could end up working. They just won't be getting paid, right, for that work until the shutdown ends. Yeah. So it's a wait and see.
Yeah, and folks would, to your point, be like, well, what's the difference to what we just went through? Now, Mitch, you've been a busy guy this year because in addition to covering politics and general news and breaking news, you are also on the White Sox beat, right, for part of the season, this past season. We're in the offseason now, and it seems like the team's kind of rebuilding. Give us the latest.
Well, the White Sox have been rebuilding for a few years now. As any fan can tell you, they've lost more than 200 games the last 2 years.
Yikes.
Doesn't get much worse than that. But general manager Chris Getz is saying that he's at least suggesting that maybe this team is finally turning a corner. Yesterday, the team announced their first big free agent signing in several years. And this is Munetaka Murakami, he's been an all-star and a former MVP in the Japanese Professional Baseball League. He's a really power-hitting first baseman, and his nickname is Mooney, which I think a lot of Chicagoans will be quick to. That's an easy one to throw out there. That's a fun one. So we'll see exactly how it goes. But you know, Bears fevers has kind of been the thing lately. But maybe this means leave some room for Mooney mania.
Yeah, here's what Chris Getz also said about Murakami. He said, quote, he's one of the most prolific power hitters on the planet. I mean, do we run the risk, Mitch, of getting too excited about this Mooney guy?
I think this is a franchise that's really just been starved of any kind of excitement for a long
I think we
time.
Need it. Yeah.
And Chris Getz definitely not underselling this. We'll see exactly how his power translates to Major League Baseball. You know, the leagues overseas, you generally don't see quite the power pitching that you do in MLB. But their scouts seem to think that this guy is the real deal. Again, he signed a smaller deal, relatively speaking, 2 years, $34 million, which isn't all that much in MLB terms, which suggests maybe his market wasn't huge in other places, obviously. But he seems excited to be here, and I think a lot of fans are excited to see him, too.
All right, Claire, you've got news on the vanity plates that Illinois rejected this year.
Yeah, so this happens every year, but Secretary of State Alexei Giannoulias sort of came out with a YouTube video today about this. Illinois released its list, more than 550 rejections of vanity license plate requests for the year.
Wow.
Giannoulias says he's praising the creativity of applicants, and there are certainly are some of these that we cannot or wouldn't want to say on public radio.
Come on, I was going to ask you for an example.
But there are some standouts like ICUP that will not be making an appearance on Illinois roads anytime soon. Secretary of State's office also says that, you know, several hundred, essentially what these are inflammatory, profane, offensive, or even just too difficult to read. A license plate request turned down in 2025. They're just a very small portion of the nearly 56,000 applications it did receive. But Giannoulias is saying it was educational for him. He now knows what a BBL is or a Brazilian butt lift. So that one also didn't make the cut.
Giannoulias is saying, keep it family friendly, folks.
That's right. And he doesn't want to be the Grinch, but he wants to keep it, you know, festive. Keep it light.
What else are you watching, Claire?
So this is interesting, especially for pet owners. A dog in Chicago has tested positive for rabies. In a statement, the Illinois Department of Public Health says it's the first rabid dog in the state since 1994, and it's the first in Cook County since before 1964, which is kind of what's interesting about this. The dog was vaccinated for rabies, apparently, in June. The exposure of this is unknown. IDPH is saying it's possible that the dog was exposed to a rabid animal animal or something like that prior to being vaccinated. So it's a good that this is a rare thing, but a good reminder that it can happen. IDPH says vaccinate your pets, folks.
Right. We're near the end of the year, Mitch. And so I wonder, as you look back, give me one or two stories that you think really changed or shaped our city and our region in 2025.
I think one that I'm really curious to see how it shapes us in the year ahead is the hemp battle that we've talked a lot about this year. These hemp-derived THC products that affect people like weed but technically aren't. They're going to be outlawed under a federal ban that takes effect next fall. But there are city aldermen who want to ban it a lot sooner. This is a billion-dollar industry, and whatever you think of it, there are a lot of jobs tied up in it. And it's been a while since we've seen any full-on industry effectively banned. So really curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and aside from that, just generally curious to see what year two of Trump 2 is like. We've obviously seen it touch basically every facet of life in Illinois, at least on the political end this year, and it doesn't show any sign of slowing down.
We got one of those earlier primary elections happening in the state too, right, on March 17th. Any races you're watching?
Only basically all the House races, because there's about a third of the Illinois congressional delegation that is either retiring or looking at other people's seats, the seats of people who are retiring. So this is like kind of a generational game of musical chairs among some of the most powerful people in Illinois.
Sure.
So that's all those congressional seats. It's going to be a pretty wild ride for the next few months.
WBEZ's Claire Lane and Mitchell Armantrout of the Sun-Times.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.